Today at Reader's Corner, Washington Post foreign correspondent Pamela Constable, author of Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself.
It's really a study of a society based on how people there think and feel. I don't believe that Pakistan is a hopeless case. I think it's a country with enormous potential. It just needs to change. Pakistan is still sort of living in the Cold War era. Once the Soviets were defeated, the United States essentially withdrew from Pakistan, and Pakistanis really feel they were abandoned. What Pakistan really needs is a much bigger middle class, which could and should be the backbone of building Pakistan as an emerging democratic country.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. More than 60 years after its founding as a Muslim democracy, Pakistan continues to struggle over its identity, alliances, and direction. In her new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, Pamela Constable takes an insightful look inside one of the world's most violent and interesting countries and the hopes, fears, and aspirations of its diverse citizenry. Playing with Fire peels back the layers of contradiction and confusion to reveal the true face of this nuclear-armed nation. Beneath the facade of democracy in Pakistan, Ms. Constable describes a country where business, bureaucratic, and military elites have a formidable hold. The majority of the population feels powerless, and competing versions of Islam fuel division and conflict. Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent and a former deputy foreign editor at the Washington Post. For the past 14 years, she has reported extensively from Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, and Iraq. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a winner of the Maria Moores Cabot Prize, and a former fellow at the Alicia Patterson Foundation and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She is also the founder of the Afghan Stray Animal League, which operates a shelter and clinic for needy small animals in South Asia. Ms. Constable joins us today from the studios of the Washington Post. Pamela Constable, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Glad to be with you in Boise.
Well, you know, it's nice to know that you're at least safe in Washington, D.C. studios, because when I read your book and hear and see where you've been, you lead a pretty dangerous life when you're not hanging around those Washington studios.
Well, I've done a lot of traveling, worked in many, many different countries, and have been very fortunate that I've had good luck and nothing terrible has ever happened to me. And I hope that that's a reflection of the positive attitude I have wherever I go.
Can you write a book like Playing with Fire and then return to it, given as accurate and alarming an account of Pakistan as it is? Can you jump right back into the country if an assignment were given to you tomorrow? Are there any problems with the aftermath of writing a book like this and then returning to the country?
Not really. I would say that, frankly, many, many people in Pakistan, you know, are just as critical, if not more critical, than the kinds of things that I say in my book. And, of course, the book is based exclusively on interviews with a wide variety of people in Pakistan, from officials, you know, down to people in villages. So there's nothing in my book that's a surprise. There's nothing that's a sort of a secret revelation. It's really a study of a society based on how people there think and feel. So the things that I write in that book, while many of them are you know, not pleasant to contemplate and are not, you know, very appealing, are really tame, frankly, in comparison to some very harsh criticism that you hear coming out of the West very often, and within Pakistan itself. It's a country in which, you know, the state is not very strong, and there are all sorts of rogue elements running around. So a second answer to your question is that, honestly, no Westerner is truly safe in Pakistan these days, you know, especially going out in the countryside, especially going into places like tribal areas. There are some big cities and where you can more or less, maintain normal activities. But still, given the level of public hostility towards Westerners and given the great amount of terrorism that goes on in that country, it is really not, generally speaking, a safe place to be.
In your book, you focus quite a bit on the extraordinary difference between the urban populations, the urban society in rural Pakistan. Were you able to travel through rural Pakistan?
Yes, to a considerable extent. I mean, there are some places that foreigners are not allowed to visit, and that makes it difficult, and makes it difficult to do a comprehensive portrait of the country. But I did do a lot of traveling, let's say, around the fringes of those areas, as well as extensive traveling in many parts of the country where foreigners are allowed to go. I focused a lot of my reporting in Punjab, which is the largest, the most important, the richest, and the most politically important province, and a place that really embodies, you know, all of the good and the bad about Pakistan, but which is relatively easy to travel in. And so that really, you know, I would say the majority of my reporting was done in Punjab, but it was also based partly on many, many years of reporting that I'd done all over Pakistan, including things like, you know, trips with the army up to, you know, conflict zones and other areas where I couldn't have gone on my own.
Well, whether urban or rural, you say that one of the most important things you've learned is that Pakistanis feel they have no power. How does that work itself out in this civil or incivil society?
I would say that, you know, it's not unique. There are many other countries where people feel this way. But as I describe in the book, everywhere I went, you know, ordinary people that I talked to expressed enormous frustration with a sense of injustice, with a sense that they didn't have outlets for their grievances, with a sense that their fates were in other people's hands, whether that was the landlord on whose land they lived, or whether it was the police chief, whether it was a court system that, you know, was operated by bribes instead of facts. You know, a wide variety of obstacles to ordinary Pakistanis feeling they have access to justice and access to basically the state. And so this creates several things. Number one, it creates a pervasive culture of corruption, which in turn corrupts everyone who's involved. And number two, it creates a wide open field for Islamic groups to come in and offer an alternative. And that's more and more what's been going on in the recent years, is that people who feel they can't get ahead, can't get anywhere in society going through the formal channels, either they look for a patron, which can help them through corrupt means, or they turn to religious organizations who promise to bring them many things, a sense of belonging, a moral framework, a purpose in life, and justice. And that's a very powerful argument for them to make.
When we think of the Islamists who have created some of these problems in the area of terrorism for these countries, we oftentimes think, as Westerners anyway, well, these are the uninformed, these are the less educated, these are the people who have only read the Quran and nothing else. But you write that there are influential people, including highly educated opinion makers, who deliberately equate national pride and patriotism with an unquestioned support for Islam, no matter what form it takes. That strikes me as particularly scary.
Yes, it is. And it's what I call the conflation of two distinct problems, one of which is, as I just described, the increasing influence of very conservative and in some cases violent Islamic groups. Their increasing influence over the society in general, which in this case, yes, we're talking about mostly poor people who are frustrated with their lives. But the second issue is that you have an entire, I should say almost cottage industry in Pakistan of anti-Westernism. You have, you know, many conservative intellectuals, politicians, journalists, people in the military, people in government, who really have very strong hostility towards the West, and who, I mean, you might just call them sort of nationalist hawks who peddle as their sort of philosophy, the notion that there is a vast conspiracy out there whose main players are the United States, Israel, and India to destroy Pakistan, to get Pakistan, to steal its nuclear weapons, to undermine, sabotage its dominant religion, Islam. And that line of argument gets expressed all the time, and not among the sort of upper reaches of Pakistani society, not only or not even principally among the poor.
And I would assume that the U.S. relationship with India plays out here as well.
Yes. I mean, it's a complicated and long history that we don't really have time to go into. But, you know, Pakistan is still sort of living in a way in the Cold War era. I mean, when the United States and Pakistan joined forces to help the Afghan guerrillas defeat the Soviet Union in the 1980s, it was a very close relationship, and Pakistan was sort of feeling at the top of the world. What happened right after that was that once the Soviets were defeated, the United States essentially withdrew from the region, withdrew from Pakistan, and Pakistanis really feel they were abandoned by the United States. Meanwhile, they've watched as the United States' relationship with India, which was once, you know, a socialist country that the United States was a bit frosty to, has turned around completely. And now, you know, there are joint ventures, you know, all over the place. There are many state visits. There's all sorts of interchange going on between India and the United States. And, of course, India and Pakistan have been at loggerheads ever since they were forcibly divided in 1948. So, yes, that has contributed greatly to the problem. Mm-hmm.
And last week, for the first time in 7 years, Pakistani and Indian leaders gathered. I believe they were in Pakistan, and with a promise that the president of Pakistan will come to Mumbai for their next meeting. I guess I have two questions. First of all, is that going to make any difference? And more to the point of your book, to what extent does the average Pakistani pay any attention to a meeting like that? Is there any significance attached to it on the part of the populace? Does it at least begin to get a Pakistani thinking about the prospect of bridge building between the two countries? Or is this animosity and hatred so deeply embedded in the culture that a visitor to on the part of the presidents isn't going to make a difference?
I'd say several things. First, I'd say, of course, it's always a good thing. It's always positive when leaders meet. Number two, remember, these are both civilian leaders. We're talking about the civilian leadership of two democratic governments meeting, which means that it's not the true epitome of power. This is a nice thing, but it's not necessarily they who are calling the shots. In a place like Pakistan, much more power resides with the military and the intelligence establishments when it comes to foreign policy, particularly vis-a-vis India. I mean, India has been the bête noire of Pakistan for a very long time in its perspective. Pakistanis, particularly in the military, they've been schooled, they've been trained for decades to view India as having hegemonic pretensions over all of South Asia, as a religious rival, and, of course, as a nuclear-armed adversary. That's, of course, been in more recent years. But that attitude towards India, that obsession with India, really dominates the thinking of Pakistan's military leadership. And just to go back a few years, I was in Agra in India, one of the last times they had a very important bilateral meeting, when President Musharraf, who was himself an army general, met with his counterpart, the Prime Minister of India, about 10 years, I think it was 2003, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, it was about a decade ago. And that was a very hopeful meeting. And there was enormous excitement generated around the meeting, hopes that there might be a breakthrough on these, some of the permanent problems between the country, particularly sort of who owns Kashmir, the disputed Himalayan region. And everybody had high hopes for those talks. But they were essentially scuttled by the hawks in both countries. And basically, you had permanent sort of establishments that really didn't want the issue to be solved at a price of making any concession on either side. And President Musharraf, again, a military man who was military president, came back from that meeting really shocked and really debilitated. And, you know, even to this day, senior people in the Pakistani army will tell you that they felt much too far. He was willing to give away the store. They weren't willing to make the kind of concessions that he had offered India, you know, as a price of peace. So even somebody that powerful was not able to break this logjam.
You're listening to Pamela Constable. She is a Washington Post correspondent who has written a book called Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Well, if the Pakistanis are truly frustrated about their daily existence and of course, in addition to that, focused on this hatred of India, they have some other problems to worry about when it comes to these wealthy families controlling so much land, the inability to exact real land reform in the country. And could you help us understand the difference between urban society and rural society, especially when it comes to these small number of families that seem to control so much of the land on which these peasants would be allowed to produce if only given more control.
Sure. I mean, in some ways, the real problem is that there's really never been any meaningful or systematic structural reform of the economy. It is still, in many ways, a feudal economy. Once you're outside the cities, you still have – it's not as bad as it was. There have been several minor reforms. So the concentration of land and wealth is not as bad as it once was, but it's still very concentrated. And even if it's not, you know, necessarily concentrated within the same family, it's concentrated within allied groups. And so you have entire huge districts of agricultural, you know, very bountiful agricultural land in places like Punjab and Sindh, which are essentially controlled by a family and its network of relatives and allies. And what this means, you know, for the peasants is that you have, you know, millions of people in Pakistan who essentially still are peasants, which means they are bound to the land and they don't own anything and they essentially are completely in thrall to these owners. Now, the stratification is particularly worrisome because what Pakistan really needs is a much bigger middle class. And what it's got instead is this tiny elite that controls, you know, both the land and much of the wealth and much of the industrial output, and a very, very large, very, very poor rural, although increasingly urban class that has very little stake and very little hope, and a much too small middle class, which could and should be the backbone of building Pakistan as an emerging democratic country. I mean, there, you know, it's really a very short-sighted. Many, many short-sighted decisions are made all the time among rulers in Pakistan and among the elite. I mean, there's this sense that, you know, it's like après moi le déluge. I mean, it's as if they don't realize what's at stake. And they're sort of clinging to the idea that, well, as long as we have our air conditioning in our house and a passport that allows us to travel, we don't really have to worry about what's going on in the rest of the country. And one of Pakistan's fiscal problems is that people don't pay taxes. It's very, very hard to get people who own businesses and who have large amounts of wealth to pay their taxes. So there's not enough revenue to help bring the poor up. And a great deal, a far too large proportion of the revenue that does come in goes to the military, which is another problem. Don't have enough willpower and you don't have enough resources going where they need to go, which is to try and bring much more of the lower class into the middle class by getting people high school educations, by getting more of them into college, by getting them into more formal jobs. Far too many people still work in the informal urban economy or, as I said before, are essentially tied to the land.
And I also read that you've got this incredible population explosion going on. What, half of Pakistanis are under the age of 15?
Something like that. And again, that's also a statistic that is true in a number of other countries. I mean, that there are a number of other countries that have, you know, too high population growths. But when you combine it in the case of Pakistan with the fact that, you know, they're running out of water, they're running out of electricity, the cities are growing much too fast, the infrastructure is woefully inadequate to support the populations that are there. So it's the combination of the population that's still growing too fast and resources that are being far too rapidly depleted for a variety of reasons. That's why you've got this demographic time bomb there. There simply isn't enough. The society can't absorb all the people it's producing. There's not enough for them to do, and there's not enough way for them to sustain themselves.
And radical Islam is sitting right over there on the sidelines just waiting for these young people who have dead-end jobs, whether it's urban or rural, to move into their ranks.
That's right. And, you know, their appeal is as I said earlier, it's quite compelling. I mean, all sorts of people Remember, this is a country that's, you know, 90% Muslim, and of that, the majority Sunni. So, you know, the terrain is very fertile there. You have, you know, as I said, a vast underclass of people who don't have enough to look forward to, that are very easily drawn to the Islamic arguments. And you also, you know, these groups are not just preaching, they're also practicing. One really good example is during the devastating floods of 2010, which destroyed millions of acres of agricultural land and left tens of thousands of people homeless, by some estimates, you know, more than a million. What happened as those floods were devastating the countryside, a number of these Islamic groups, they're very well organized, have lots of volunteers, lots of very determined acolytes, went to these regions and started helping people. They started giving out medicine. They started giving out food. They took a much more active role in this than in many cases the government. So they capitalize on every opportunity that comes their way. And people remember this. People look to them for a variety of things, one of which is charity.
You're listening to Pamela Constable. She's the Washington Post correspondent, and she is the author of Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Of course, there's nothing external about a tribal custom, the likes of which a young woman named Rukshana in your book struggled with. Why don't you just tell us that story to give us an idea about the incredible impact and influence of some of these tribal customs?
Yes, that's another major problem in terms of Pakistan's inability to develop socially in a way that would be better, and that is that it has a large rural population, mostly people who live in villages where they've lived their whole lives, and those villages are dominated by the male elders of those areas. And remember, most of these people are not literate. Semi-literate at best, and it's a very, you know, patriarchal society. So the men are sort of deciding these things. And tribal culture has its own, you can't call it laws, but its own rules that have nothing to do with the state, nothing to do with, you know, what the state considers, you know, right and wrong and legal or illegal. And it's the priorities of these more rural, more village conservative tribes have exclusively to do with keeping the tribe united, making sure that girls stay within the clan, that they don't marry outside, that they don't get involved with boys or men anywhere else. And the decisions are made for them by the male tribal leaders. The happiness of the woman is completely irrelevant. And more than that, women are, and girls particularly, are used within that tribal system as forms of barter and forms of legal recompense. If you kill somebody from another clan, that victim's family can demand that you give them girls, you know, virgins from your family or tribe will be given to the other side to be married off to anyone they wish, in compensation for the crime. So again, this has nothing to do with the state or the police. These are sort of deals which have been made, you know, for centuries, and their names for it, and they all, there's tried and true practices that go on to this day. In some cases, the state intervenes. Usually it doesn't. Usually nobody even knows. And the only times the cases come to light is usually through the press. Now, the case you're talking about of Rukshana, which I describe in my book, was exceptional in the fact that it did come to light. She was a young woman from a small village in Sindh, and at a very early age, I think it was 3, she was promised to a man from another family by her own family in compensation for a crime. I believe it was an accidental death of someone in that other family. So there it was. She's promised to this other guy. Meanwhile, she grows up, goes to school, ends up going to college, and becoming rather well-educated for her station in life. So she gets an education and gets some inkling of her rights and opportunities. And when the day comes that the family goes to her and says, okay, now you're 21, you have to go marry this guy because you were promised to him when you were 3, she refused, which is almost unheard of. She refused and she ran away. Now, she ran away with a guy who was a distant cousin who had promised to help her and who eventually married her to help her get out of this mess. And the two of them essentially went out on the run with, you know, everybody chasing after them and the tribe chasing after them and the police chasing after them. And they finally ended up in the capital hiding in a shelter. It's a long, complicated story. But at one point, the police caught them and took them back. And they were, you know, if they had been allowed or forced to go back to their village, they both would have been killed by their own families and by their own tribal leaders. They ended up, through a complicated series of events, living in a government shelter for their protection. But, you know, the sad thing about it was that even as they were safe physically in this shelter, they knew that the fact that she had defied this ancient tribal culture and system of rules meant that even if she was safe, temporarily at least, her family was going to be persecuted and hounded forever. They would become pariahs, ostracized from their own little world. And that was a very, very, very painful thing for this young woman to know that she had caused, by her own defiance of that ancient system, terrible grievance and heartache for her own family, which would essentially never be accepted again within their own tribe.
Well, you have a few other examples like this, and by the time you get to the end of the book, I must say there are these moments where I jotted down for my notes to talk with you, Pakistan, a hopeless democracy, and yet I never like to use that word hopeless. And when I got to the end of your book, I got to an epilogue. And what do you know? In the epilogue, there's this incredible story, this sign of hope. I don't know whether I'm pronouncing the gentleman's name right, Abdul Satur Edhi. Or something
close,
like that,
yes.
Okay? And as you describe him, a cross between Gandhi and Mother Teresa. Maybe we can close on just what this gentleman has contributed to the civil society of his homeland.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned him because I deliberately saved him for the end because both my editor and I knew that the book had a lot of tragic and bleak aspects to it. So I did want to end on a positive note because I don't believe that Pakistan is a failed state. Right. I don't think it's a hopeless case. I think it's a country with enormous potential. It just, you know, needs to change.
Sure.
But the fellow you're talking about, Abdul Satur Edhi, he's an elderly gentleman with a long beard. Just an extraordinary man. And what he's known for is that he founded a free ambulance service for the poor in Pakistan, which doesn't sound like much, but it's basically, in many cases, the only medical service that a lot of poor people get. I mean, the ED ambulances, you know, they go to plane crashes, train crashes, bus crashes. They pick up dead bodies. They take people to hospitals. They get them medical care. But even more than that, they help orphans find homes. They help mentally ill people get out of institutions. It's become a sort of a parallel charity for the poor in a country where the state often does not do enough for them. But more important than that is his philosophy. You know, Mr. Edhi does not believe in just giving things to the poor. He truly is a revolutionary who believes in empowering the poor. And much of his activity and the activity of his army of volunteers that worship him and that work with him all over the country is to give meaning and dignity to the life of people who don't get it in that society. And that's why he's such an extraordinary man, and that's why I call him in my book possibly Pakistan's only true national hero.
Pam, that's a great way to end this interview. Again, I can't thank you enough for coming onto the show, for writing the book. Again, it's Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, a great way for the American public to get to know this country that we simply cannot choose to forget. It is encouraging to know that your work will be read by many, and let's hope influenced in the halls of Congress and in the office of the president. Thank you so much for joining us today on Reader's
it's
Corner.
It's been a great pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Again, the name of the book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, by Pamela Constable. Next week, Richard Reeves, author of the national bestseller Daring Young Men, The Heroism and Triumph of the Berlin Airlift. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Matt Penny. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.